Spartina is what's called salt hay. Spartina will develop on shallow flats into great fields, and then you do just what you do on a landfill. You run ditches so it drains the, when the tide goes out, it drains fairly well. Then they take ordinary tractors and haymakers and go on and make hay out of Spartina. Get several cuts a year in cold climates. And this is the great mulch of the maritime provinces of Canada and United States. You can buy this salt hay bale. It's grass. It's not itself salty. It's called salt hay because it's cut off the saltings. It's a good fodder, and it's also excellent mulch, and it's the mulch of all the coast from New York State north into Canada. Now, these are the mulches we want. They're the return mulches from sea to land. I often think about just establishing a garden just inshore of these deposits so that we actually we could produce a market garden out here on the point that would feed the whole of this bloody, the whole of the 37,000 people in this whole district from the Arthur River to on one patch of land mulched with this stuff. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm too old and I couldn't be bothered. I can't feed themselves as far as I'm concerned. I can starve. but we could do it easily. And you could do it. I also brought a lot in when I was at Adelaide and mulched gardens there, and the results were excellent. And we did it, we've been using it a lot in the desert in those little pits that we showed you at Ceduna, because we're only 4 miles from big deposits of it. So they're all great things. Now, as you come out across these saltings, the only use to which we have put salicornia is as a pickle. And it's a lot of it is pickled. We pickle small quantities of it, of course, just small quantities. Basically, it's better than pickled onions. You just pick it and drop it into vinegar. You don't have to give it a salt soak. And it's crisp and delicious. Sells very well in England, throughout England. It's eaten with jellied eels and things like that. Jellied eels and salicornia pickle. We pickle a little bit of it when we think of it, which is hardly ever. I pickled about 2 jars last year. Apart from that, the salicornia zone, which is extensive, is not much used by us, but it is subject to the same treatment as we would give marshes. It would be a shame to do more than a small proportion of the salicornia beds because they have a right to exist too. But the one thing they're excellent for and they've been used for in this district was goose grazing. They are the real goose habitat par excellence. And until recent years, the last 30 years, they all held very large flocks of geese. And they would have been at one time the area that the Cape Barren geese would have occupied. Those are now confined to the islands. In the Northern Hemisphere, the Brent goose, which is a small goose, uses this zone and the Spartina beds. But here our geese have always done well out on the saltings, and horses do extremely well if they have access to some of this too. And the main horse rearing areas of the world always include a little bit of coastal dune and salting. So they're those two good things. However, if you chenamper it, what you've done is set yourself up a tide control, because only 1 foot or 2 feet of wall prevents free tidal ingress. Therefore, now what you've done is you've set up a tide control. And if your outlet to the sea looks like that, and you have a set of boards, you can now determine the amount of sea tide that you allow into your ponds. if you had 8 feet, you can wall it up to 6 feet of depth and keep 6 feet of tide inside your pond. So you don't have a low tide, you can have a 12-inch tide or a 2-foot tide, whatever you like. What you've got effectively now is a self-flushing swimming pool in which you can disport yourselves, and with a clear plastic tent over it, you can swim all the year up and down your own salt ponds with no fear of chlorine poisoning. Inside there, temperatures can be kept very constant, and you can breed oysters by just giving them the correct exposure, which is 60% under the tide and 40% out. 40% of the tide cycle exposed, 60% submerged, is the perfect place for growing oysters. Any more submerged, and they have a very high shell to meat ratio. Any more emerged, and they are very slow growing. But that's just nice. And you can be a little rough about it, but, you know, somewhere in there. Submerged oysters, however, spawn readily. And you can submerge choice oysters for spawning off for spat. And that's a very lucrative occupation. There are other things you can do in these tide ponds. 6 or 7 feet deep, you can actually rear flounder. You don't even have to catch the flounder. You set up through this inlet, I'll take a section of the inlet. Here are our boards, which we've put in to stop the tide going out. And then at tide level, as the tide comes up, we can put a funnel trap so that the water can come in through a funnel, and so can the fish. It's been long known that if you make your funnel exit that size, only small or flat fish can come in. And if you make it like that, you get the round fish like the mullet coming in. And these come in but can't go out. So naturally, over all tides, you get a constant entry of fish. You can then put them through a second funnel, make it even more difficult for them to come home, out again, and rear them in these ponds. There are an awful lot of very small flounder that coast along these beaches that are usually predated. But by putting them in ponds and by keeping some sort of eye on predators, you can rear them to good fish. And they are a good pond fish, flounder, and a high value fish. Once you've set up ponds, you can think about what you want to grow. Crayfish possible. The main stocks of crayfish left in the sea are undersized fish of very slow growth. They're a sedentary animal, the crayfish. They move occasionally, not very often, across sands. Therefore, all the crayfish that are around the nut are all the crayfish there probably will be. As we've had maybe 100 years of maximum size limit, all the big crayfish have been caught. And all the small crayfish remain. And the small crayfish are now in total biomass more than the original large crayfish. Therefore, there's no room anymore in the sea for a large crayfish. The biomass is filled up with small crayfish. Now, we need to remove the little buggers. They all stop at 4 1/8 inches because the legal size is 4 1/4. And the way they stop is interesting because they're a heavily fished population. The front of the shell is that shape. The eyes come out here. And the shell goes back there. And the legal measure is taken from the tip of the rostrum to the rear of the carapace. And it's a little thing you carry on a fishing boat, little bronze measuring stick. Okay, well, the crayfish know this as well as we do. So the normal rostrum, the shell profile's there, and the rostrum comes out, then the eyes. Normal rostrum's a good, straight, forward-looking rostrum, wherever the crayfish is not fished. As soon as you start to fish the crayfish, the rostrum turns back. So that when you measure from the tip of the rostrum, you're getting a shorter crayfish than when you measure from the tip of the rostrum with a straight rostrum. They do one other thing. They get up to 4 1/4 inches and they cease to grow longitudinally, and the rostrum simply enlarges laterally. So you have short, broad crayfish. You have rostrum-less crayfish that have completely discarded growing a rostrum at all. If you're going to measure from the rostrum, they don't want to know about it at all. And crayfish with rostra which actually recurve. And you'll only find those in fished populations. So here is a crayfish rapidly outthinking the fisheries inspectors or the fishermen. You can find all of these crayfish, and in fact, I'll go further than that, you can find nothing but these crayfish in heavily fished grounds. And that all arose because the legal thing was to take the big crays and throw the little crays back. In the old days, only the big crayfish spawned, and it's still partly true, and the average egg count we get off them was 40,000 eggs. Now, only the little crayfish spawn, and they only spawn 1,000 or 2,000 eggs. So what you've got is a dwarfed population. The effect is exactly equivalent to putting a lethal what are those beams that cut through things?
Laser
beam above the street at a height of 5 feet 3.5 inches. Don't do it very long, and nobody who would reach that height has children. Therefore, before long, you've got a lot of dwarfs running around, and it doesn't take very long at all. And with crayfish, that happened a long time ago. Grab those little dwarf sods and put them in here, in pipes, giving each one a pipe so they've had, for the first time in their lives, a little bit of room, and they're not crowded up against another 1,000 dwarfs, and they grow extremely rapidly. And we need to remove these dwarf populations entirely from the sea. My advice to people catching small crayfish is, do what you like, but never throw them back. Jump on them, smash them,
eat them,
pound them up as fish bait, but whatever you do, never throw one back. Because if you remove 6 and kill them, one crayfish will then grow large enough. I would say we should reverse the fishery regulations and make the traps so they will only admit small crayfish. Get back to large, fast-breeding, fast-growing crayfish of normal weight, and catch the little guys and eat them.
But then we won't be allowed.
They would have an endless fishery.
Then we won't be allowed to eat the big ones ever.
They're called oversized crayfish. You get arrested for possession of an oversized crayfish. It'd be a nice change, and it would bring the fishery back to fantastic productive capacity. Now, this is all straightforward stuff. I've carefully explained it to the sea fisheries groups. I've carefully explained it to fishermen. They all agree with me, and nobody does anything.
Because it takes a politician to do it.
Politicians only go for votes, and of course, when you say to the electorate, we are protecting the little baby crayfish, everybody's tears roll down their cheeks and they say, that's the right thing to do, look after the babies.
Why do the fishermen get their act together?
They're a disparate, pig-headed, dumb lot of idiots. I used to be one. I can speak with authority. And they are always ranging another 1,000 miles to strike a new bed of crayfish, right? So already the South Australians and our boats pass each other somewhere out there past Kinong. I was in the great last of the great shark race when the Queenscliff boats and the Stanley boats used to go past each other in the night on their way to their secret fishing grounds. Ours near Queenscliff, theirs near here. There's the crayfish biomass curve. Here's the legal size limit. And these all die without ever being utilised. And we should be operating here. No good as eating crayfish below that size, and no good as eating crayfish above that size. But if we operated here, we'd have, this would be a relatively larger portion. This is the only place we get efficient breeding. And this would also expand. So we'd be on an endless take. So we can grow little crayfish in here, and I think it's about historical time that you will be allowed to do that from now on. I think there'll be little trouble doing that. Fish, oysters, mussels, you tend to grow on ropes in tideways, and seaweeds you can grow also on rafts or off rafts on ropes. And these are large fisheries in Japan and in Ireland. Ireland has taken to the sea very well. Ireland has a long and continuing history of sea culture. In Ireland, in the shallows in Ireland, there are, you'll see only from the air, extensive rock lines under the sea. They're called fields by the Irish, and they made them by carrying the stones from the shore out in long lines, and they you can actually get onto most of them at dead low water, and they go out at half water, cut the seaweed, tie it in great bundles and bring it in and sell it. It's been an industry for from prehistory. The Irish have harvested the sea, as far as we know, when there were no Irish, when they were only the fur bowl, the little people probably built the walls. And the Irish have taken to all these cultures, cage culture of salmon. They have very large sheltered inlets in which they catch mussel row on ropes. Then they tow the ropes right round the coast and put them in warmer waters and grow the mussels on. That's been happening many years. They have a good oyster fishery and so on. And the other thing that the Hawaiians do is to wall in a part of the sea coast with large coral blocks there, and sometimes volcanic blocks, which they took out on canoes and tipped over. And that's they always do that wherever a river or stream enters the sea. And that means that the last of the land nutrient is walled into a sea impoundment. Now, they are very extensive. There are many miles of those impoundments along the mouths of all streams. And then the land nutrient pauses for a while and the sea animals grab it very quickly. In those impoundments they rear mullet. And they're fish eaters from way back and they eat raw fish. And they can blindfolded tell you from which pond which mullet came. And it depends on the ratio of algae in the pond. And they're famous ponds with preferred mullet, where they pay twice as much for mullet from a good pond as from a bad pond. They also rear very large crabs in there, and quite a lot of fish, in effect. And recently, a friend of mine bought them, and he's put tilapia in, and the tilapia are going well in this semi-saline water. And he's got koi in there. Do you know the koi, those big golden carp? So he's starting to really complex sea ponds, things which we think of as freshwater.
Are they the big mullet, are they? Big sand?
They're the grey mullet, Mugulcephalus. They are big.
Mm, yeah, beautiful.
Nice fish. And they're diatom eaters. You couldn't get anything lower on the ladder. All you've got to do is throw a few decayed leaves in and they're off. So they are fascinating places. They had a very sophisticated water control system. I said had, because what's happened to most of the Hawaiian ponds is that the cattlemen got the country inland most of the country fell off the sides of the mountains, went down the streams and filled up the ponds. So most of them are big, flat, dry patches of land. Hawaii may have been paradise, but some fools got in there. Certainly not at all paradisical now. It uses 30% of the total pesticides used in the United States, and it is 0.00% of the 0.01% of the surface area. So it's about the most poisonous place in America. Also, they store 20,000 atomic warheads on there, and on some of the islands, most of the nerve gases. So paradise isn't very nice at present. Right, just little asides to cheer you up. Go to beautiful Hawaii and have a hula and get your head smashed open by a Hawaiian, because the Hawaiians are really fierce about what's happened.
How many of them left, are
they? 8%. Mm. Now, where do we get to? Something on the marine fishery. What you basically do is extend the skills of aquaculture into the water's edge. A word on rafts and rafting. The raft. Today you would make the raft out of this hard plastic, which you can make absolute watertight joins on. You can make up either square units or bridged units, all with glue-up joints, and they last indefinitely. The other way you can make them is to put silicone glue on flagon lids and screw them back on the flagons and make a net for the flagons, and they will float indefinitely. So there are two cheap ways to make raft supports today. Now we've got free bottles and free plastic tubes. What can you use a raft for? You can use it. You can bridge it over easily enough and put insect breeding systems on. You can float a glass house on it. You can depend a net from it or a curtain from it. You can set rafts out, which are basically plant systems in which you're looking for plants that want constant water level, like taro. And it doesn't matter to you now whether you get evaporation or floods. The plant experiences the same water level. I have actually designed and set out flower rafts for clients so that they've got a flower raft drifting around on a short tether in their ponds. You know, I mean, you can, it's up to you. You can hang baskets from the rafts and grow water lilies from them, and they like that situation. You know, you just take a raft and think what you can't do with it. Rafts are marvellous places for duck nests. And you can put them on a tether so they blow around the pond, or you can fix them in position. The advantage a raft has over anything else is it doesn't care about the water level. It follows it. So it's up to you. Friends of mine have made them, simply throwing bales of hay on them. The ducks sit up on them and crap on them, and the whole thing turns into a great weedy island, which ducks use a lot. And these things, like glass and caught down below, plastic caught down below, then they just float forever. So there's no worry about renewing them. Go and stuff a couple more flagons in underneath the system. Nylon mesh. Fastened round these and hanging down can be filled up with straw or some base material and then earthed over, and they are pretty well indefinite systems. They'll be there when your grandfather's dead. So rafting is a very good way to rehabilitate or retrofit dams that were made without islands. It's also a good way to grow certain plants. Rafts are also used as feeding stations for fish. You feed inside the raft so the fish know where to go. They're also extensively used by fish as cover One of the ways of cutting out cormorants is to hang a large mesh, a shark net, which doesn't catch fish, it's too big, from a raft, and the fish will flee under the raft, the cormorant chases them and catches a cormorant. The fish then eat the cormorant instead of the opposite thing happening. And that's very effective. So you can hang a shark net in the water and catches cormorants as they chase your fish, especially if you put the net around fish cover by brush. Fish all head there when the cormorant gets in the water and the cormorant heads in after. Goodbye, cormorant. So rafts, I think you can play around with what you might like to do with a raft. The Irish rafts are interesting in that they're double rafts and they have a catwalk all the way around them and a fence on the inner raft. Fence, it's about 3 feet high, and they have a loose mesh cover and a deep curtain. And you can walk around on the outside and feed fish and inspect the whole situation. They're made up of those big, heavy black plastic loops, you know, those big commercial heavy black plastic pipes, flexible ones.
What's that for? Where do you get them?
They're for rearing salmon in tideways. Oh, you can buy them anywhere, can't you?
I haven't run into it yet.
I passed one the other day, 12 inches through. About that thick in the walls. Somewhere running up and down country. Yeah, well, they always leave them lying around, don't they? So you see a lot of 2-inch black plastic pipe cut off and lying around, don't you? Yeah, just buy the fittings and put it together and you've got yourself a raft. You could be honest and pay for one, you know. Or you can use a wooden frame and just put a netting, nylon netting, and just put flagons in. A perfectly good raft. And you can float an awful lot of material on a very small raft. I think it needs a third of a cubic foot to support us in the water, something very tiny. I mean, if you had a flagon under your jump, you could paddle across Bass Strait. Well, tomorrow. Today you come back. So you go into the sea. Now I think we haven't started to go into the sea. I notice that there is now a marine tractor which you can crawl down under the sea and do your jobs. And that's probably going to be quite important over large areas of the inshore sea. There has been a constant report of success last hearing about in San Francisco of making fish reefs in sand areas. The best one, of course, is tyres tied together with plastic. Makes a marvellous reef and it's a very rich fish environment. Car bodies don't last very long in the sea. Maybe 4 years, you've got a reef. After that, you've got rust. Old ferries, old boats we have used in Tasmania. Instead of wrecking them, we've filled them with stone and sunk them and made excellent fish reefs with them. So you can set up reefs. What the Hawaiians did was a little more intricate, and if you get near the tropics, you can use it. What they used to do is cut coconut logs and make log hoops. And the coconut logs sink, of course, when they're fresh cut. They're down under the water about a week and the coral welds them together and turns them into a coral reef. And the Hawaiians build hundreds and hundreds of these all along the reef country. And they've all got painted crayfish in them. And they built them out of coral blocks and of logs that they sank and which turned into coral. In the Seychelles, we built quite a lot of them and put them in the lagoons, and they became rich fish areas. And it's not long before they weigh about a ton and you can't move them. They're glued to the bottom and glued to each other. They've got living things all over them. So you can build wooden structures that sink in the sea, and then the coral does the rest. The coral attaches to it and glues them together and makes a permanent job of them. And they're quite nice things to do. But I've no doubt that when you get to atoll situations, providing you've got some coconut logs, you can do an awful lot in atolls as far as fish traps and fish lagoons are concerned. They are heavy things, yeah. Fortunately, you can pull them straight into the sea and tow them out underwater without much effort at all. If you tow them out on the tide...
Put them together in low water, then tow them in.
Yeah, or take them out and put them together at low water. Tow them out as individuals and bind them together at low water. You're going to have to bind them together, you don't have to nail them. And then a week or two later, you won't get them apart. Somebody's making houses in the sea by letting in mesh and then putting a light current across it and depositing calcium on, so you have the whole house formed and haul it out with a crane and wheel it off inland. So you got yourself a coral house in a matter of about 4 days, I think. It needs a very small current to do that. It's a real free-form house too. Make the house whatever shape you like, coralise it, and then take it inland. All right, unless you've got acid rain. Okay, well, is there anything you want to know about aquaculture or mariculture? I've now been trudging around looking in every bloody pond I can find that people are growing things in. You'll find a lot of Australians here and there, if we could ever gather them up, are well on their way with aquacultures. One thing about the Murray cod, which I may have told you, is the first guy who started to breed them put a cup 60 in his dam. I've heard him lecture, maybe you have, and they never bred. And he had them practically numbered and named. And got to the stage where he knew there were 12 left or 14 left, and there's no sign of little Murray cod. And there was a big wind gale and blew his tank away, and his tank ended up in the dam. And the remaining 12 Murray cod went inside the tank and spawned. So the way you grow Murray cod is throw your tank in. And basically what it chanced on is the fact that they are hollow log spawners, and those big river red gums, when they fell in, would represent a large cavern for them to spawn in. But in a country dam, you don't have anything like that, so just a big tank does, and it needs to be only two-thirds submerged. And they go inside there and they spawn quite happily. That guy's now selling little Murray cod to everybody. He's a nice fella too, actually. He's got hundreds of little Murray cod all through his waters now. So there's often some little thing like that that we haven't provided or should provide. Brush piles are real critical things in water. Piles of tea tree tied together and thrown in are real critical. They breed an awful lot of things off them. Hollow logs, hollow pipes, brush piles, they're your three things. Hessian bags. Ah, what, open bags or just... Hanging in the dam? Lying on the mud. In it. McYabby tells me that if you every beer can you throw in gets a big yabby in it. And he ties them in bundles of 15 on a cord and lets them down, gets a dozen yabbies per bundle. Big ones, they all back in there. Beer can. And he floats a ping pong ball on top so he knows where they are, so you see his little areas covered with ping pong balls. On the bottom of every ping pong ball there's 12 big yabbies.
Where is this?
McYabby. Ian Carstairs. He wrote, you know, there's a photographic meaning. Have you got the book on the yabby?
No, I haven't got it.
Oh.
Have you got it down here in this library?
Yeah, it's in the library.
The yabby it's called, is it?
Yeah, and McCabe's in there. You can see he's got his water glass on his head, and he's got his flippers on his feet, or above the water. He's flipping. You can see his little face through this glass, and in each hand he's got a yabby. And that's all you can see of him. He's a Scotsman who's called himself the McGabby. He's mad about yabbies. Just harking back to our very first day on what was sustainable systems, we said the waters, the forests and the meadows and permanent pastures and the non-cultivation systems. So we're going to deal with them all, and I think we've had a pretty fair slap at the water. And you have enough information and sense, I think, to make a good job of recommending water systems, even to the small backyard systems. And we should probably take it upon ourselves to develop some little puddles in our own garden. You can grow plant systems in water for plant food and do it very successfully. They're very high nutrient plants. There are even, and I brought some out and we grew it up to tassel stage here, wild rice, which is a high quality grain, Zizania aquatica. Yeah, it's grown now from Florida right through to Canada in, of course, typical monoculture fashion, 1,000-acre fields, sown down with huge machines. And I think it's valid to grow wild rice in small quantities. The guy I was talking to who really started it all, his name's Jacobson. He was the first person in the world to domesticate wild rice. He said, when I started, we used to grow each little wild rice in a tube. Put each seed in a tube and we'd put it in a little shallow water system, just grew it in damp soil. And then we planted it out and we got 1/2 pound of wild rice per head off each of our plants. He said, because now we grow it by the 1,000 acres and I get 800 pounds of wild rice per acre. So 1,600 little plants planted out in tubes gives you the equivalent of a wild rice acre. And I just thought to myself, why in the hell didn't he go and grow it in tubes, you know? Mm-hmm. Here he is with a $160,000 aquatic mower thing. And mm-hmm. Why didn't he keep growing in tubes and go and teach everybody how to grow it in tubes and make an honest living teaching people how to grow your own little patch of wild rice instead of this great monoculture he's set up? But he's still a human being, and he has built giant levee systems with it. He used a guy to scoop them out, and they turned out to be 12 feet high, the levees, and these side ditches about 8 feet deep. And he said to him, I asked him why he made them so big. He said, I like making them big. So he's got these huge levees running around where you can drive along the top of them. In here, has set up its own population of crayfish and minks and stoats, and beavers have stopped off a lot of these and are living in them, and he doesn't mind all that. And the crayfish come out and eat all the wild rice to about here, about 15 feet in from the ditches. And he's just starting to say, I said to him, have you looked at the crayfish yield? He said, no, but I've asked my son, would he like to run the ditches for crayfish yield? Then there are thousands of duck come in. I suspect that's why he's only getting 800 pounds per acre, but he likes the duck. So all in all, he's not a bad guy, even with his huge machine. And certainly this system is the most living agriculture I've ever seen, with little minks scampering around, coyotes running along the banks, beavers flapping and diving, muskrats. Very pleasant.
Where is
it? It's in the Millark region, north of Thousand Lake region, north of Minneapolis, St. Paul. The man's name is Jacobson.
Well, we just end up farming, rigging up the seed and harvesting all the...
Well, as he sells it at $6 a kilogram and takes off just on $1 million worth annually, some years $3 million, he's not worried. He said, this year I take off enough wild rice to pay for all my research and all my toil for 30 years. Said, my time and all my machinery, all my land and all my worry has been paid for in one crop. Yeah. Hmm? Yeah, he thinks so. He told me he believes it's only valid in small systems. And I believe he's right.
Can we get Waldo?
Strange that. You strike with some of these. Yeah, you can get it from him. He'll post it to you. He's posted. He said, I took the first 12 pounds to the southern hemisphere. I went and put it in the dam, and the ducks ate it. And they ate every bit of it. And the bit that they didn't eat, the native hen pulled out and ate as they came through the water. I put some in one of Ted's bars and it came up and tasseled and we didn't get a seed off it. But it'll grow well here.
What's the bird
called? Millark, I think. We'll get it. Yeah. I've got the whole deal somewhere. Should put it in the quarterly, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, well, of course, that's brought in. Postage. Postage. Cost me $5 to post it, actually. Millac, M-I-L-L-A-C. It's a corruption of the French trapping.
M-I-L-L-A-C.
M-I-L-L-A-C. I reckon if you wrote to Mr. Jacobson, Wild Weisker, Mill Lark, where is Minneapolis, St. Paul? Wisconsin. I'll bet he'd get it. There's nobody else around Mill Lark. Yeah, Minnesota. Yeah, write to Mr. Jacobson, Wild Weisker, Mill Lark, Minnesota. I'll bet he gets it. Because he does all the processing there too, and he's well known in the whole district. It's like writing to Bill Mollison Stanley, he gets it, you know. So Cezania aquatica, there are other very good aquatic grains, of course rice is one, but so is the duck rices, the glycerias. We brought some home. They were widely eaten by people until such things as rice and came in. They're smaller grains, more nutritious of course than rice, and there is aquatic millets too. So there's quite a lot of grass grains grow in shallow water. We have some glycerea, which we brought home, has little nutty seeds about as big as match heads. Wild rice is a magnificent plant, most beautiful plant. Again, travelling around and looking in people's ponds and asking people locally, you just find a whole host of useful aquatics that are not really assembled anywhere, listed anywhere. In Australia, you have the little fern, nardoo, which Neil Douglas grows. It's got a nice little nutlet, which is actually a spore packet, which is a staple of the Aborigines. Excellent wildlife food. Nardoo fern. And we've got edible rooted water lilies and all sorts of things in Australia, and it's in that Wild Foods of Crib, and also in that new book out on Australian Aquatics, who I've forgotten, a woman wrote that. That's in the library there. There's quite a lot of good things laid out for you there.